We are going to start today with to finish the work session that we started, open a work session on Senate Bill 89, and finish the work that we started yesterday. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When this bill was heard yesterday, at that time we had not received the Dash 2 amendment. The Dash 2 amendment is now in your packets. And the function of the Dash 2 amendment is to create an affirmative defense in the limited circumstance of probation, post-prison supervision, or otherwise supervised release. And the affirmative defense is the lack of supervisory authority by the defendant over the protected person. This defense would not apply to the section of the statute that concerns sexual contact between a defendant who is an employee of a correctional institution or the Oregon Enterprise organization and an inmate. It is strictly for the non-custodial probation setting. There is also a statement from Amnesty International in the packet that they asked to circulate opposing the Dash 2 amendment.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee on the Dash 2 amendment? Maybe you could just elaborate on the difference between an affirmative defense
Certainly.
And an outright defense.
Certainly. Under the criminal code, when the legislature labels something an affirmative defense, the function of that is that it is on the burden is on the defendant to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the circumstances exist. So by calling this an affirmative defense rather than a garden variety defense, the impetus is on the defendant to come forward, and the burden of persuasion is on the defendant to the fact finder, be it a jury or a judge, by preponderance of the evidence that the condition exists. And in this case, the condition would have to be that there was no supervisory authority over the protected person.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Senator Pruzanski?
Joe, could you go over that? I could go over that one more time
on the last part about where you're saying that the lack of supervisory authority. Give me a context or an example.
Sure. An example would be, for example, at the public hearing, the ACLU's objection to the bill as originally drafted cited a janitor that is an employee of the probation office who is engaging in a sexual relationship with someone who is on probation. The janitor knows that person is on probation. Under the bill as originally drafted, the janitor would be guilty of a Class A misdemeanor or a Class C felony, depending on the level of sexual contact. The Dash 2 amendment would give that same individual the opportunity to assert an affirmative defense, the defense being, the janitor, had no supervisory authority over the probationer. Even though I knew the person was on probation and I had whatever degree of sexual contact, you shouldn't hold me liable because I had no supervisory authority over them. And then that would be up to the jury to decide whether or not that was a sufficient enough reason to withstand criminal culpability.
I appreciate that. I wanted to make sure we had something on the record that actually articulate why this would be. So basically, the way I'm reading this and from your explanation, if the person who's the offender does not have what I'm going to call some type of direct supervisory authority, even though they may work for an agency that does have supervisory authority over the individual that's the alleged victim, that they would not be held to the same standard as someone that's, let's say, P&P probation officer who actually is monitoring that person within that case bank.
That's correct. If it were somebody on that person's caseload, that affirmative defense would certainly, if you have a defendant probation officer and a complaining witness probationer, and that probation officer is supervising the probationer, I would say either directly or indirectly, the statute, I think, is not too specific as to what that means on purpose, that would prevent that person from exerting the affirmative defense. The other thing I'd want to point out is the same hypothetical janitor who is employed by the Department of Corrections or the Oregon Corrections Enterprise would not have that affirmative defense available to them as to someone who is in the custody setting in the institution. And I think the reasoning behind that by the parties that were discussing it was that that the person who is actually in custody is differently situated from the person who is on probation and not in a lockdown setting.
I agree with that. So one other question with me. I'm just skimmed over the Oregon Amnesty International. Did you get a chance to read
theirs?
I mean, it seems to me that part of the concerns that they raise is really contradictory to what we're trying to accomplish with the Dash 2s. So where you have an individual that's such as the custodian in an out-of-custody situation would not be caught up. And is it your understanding and your, I guess, hopefully closer analysis of the this position paper from the Amnesty International that they believe anyone and everyone that works for an agency that has that type of supervisory position should be held to the same standard, and it doesn't make a difference if they're actually a probation officer as compared to a custodian?
I don't want to speak for them, but my understanding from reading their position paper is that if you work for an institution, if you work for a probation office, an office that supervises individuals on probation, that you should be held to a higher standard no matter what. And their point, the point they make is that many people on probation are have psychological issues, have substance abuse issues that make them vulnerable to being taken advantage of.
Thank you.
Thank you for getting that on the record, Senator Pruzanski. And, you know, it was discussed to try to extend this into the custodial situation as well, and it was determined after a lot of discussion that it's very difficult, if not impossible, in a custodial situation to determine that somebody wouldn't be able to exert authority over people.
I think in a custodial situation, you are talking about a completely different situation standard, and it should be a different standard because that individual is basically, not at free will to exercise their own independence because they are in a lockdown. And I can see where anyone that comes in contact with them as compared on the outside, and I think the example that Mr. O'Leary has given us clearly demonstrates the difference and why I would be able to support the Dash 2s.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions, comments from the committee? Senator Starr, do you have a motion on the Dash 2 amendments?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move the Dash 2 amendments, Senate Bill 89.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 89. Is there a discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 89 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 89 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Senator Byers.
Was the Dash 1 adopted yesterday?
That's correct.
Okay.
Is there any other discussion? But thank you for bringing that to light because it may not have been in the case. Thank you. Is there other discussion? Thank you. Any objections? So ordered. Senate Bill 89 has been adopted, and I will carry it. Okay. We will now open. Everybody's here. We will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 99. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 99 comes to you from the Department of Human Resources and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. It allows a health care provider or health insurer to retain genetic information of individual without obtaining permission for the individual or person representing the individual if retention is for the health care providers or the insurer's own treatment, payment, and health care operations.
Okay. We have signed up Catherine Bradley and Gwen Dayton and Emily Harris. If all three are here, we will just start with you. Thank you.
Chairperson, I'm Catherine Bradley, the administrator for the Office of Family Health. And if it pleases the committee, what I'd like to do is introduce the original testimony that we have from the department and then defer to Gwen and to Emily, who have the expertise as co-chair of our advisory committee, to address these issues further.
Thank you. Could you speak a little closer to the mic?
I certainly can. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Bradley, and I'm the administrator of the Office of Family Health at the Department of Health Services. I'm here today to offer testimony in support of Senate Bill 99, which regards retention and disclosure of genetic information. Senate Bill 99 proposes to bring state law into line with federal health information protection law. That's the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996, which we are all aware of now as HIPAA. It eliminates the requirement for specific patient authorization for the use, release, and retention of genetic information. Oregon's genetic health privacy laws are more stringent than HIPAA's. Adoption of this bill will align our state law with federal regulations and reduce paperwork in hospitals, doctors' offices, and in other clinical settings. It's important to note that the scope of this proposed change applies to clinical health care settings only. It will have no effect on Oregon's genetic privacy laws in the context of insurance, employment, or research. This policy proposal was developed in cooperation with and is fully endorsed by the Advisory Committee on Genetic Privacy and Research, ACGPR. ACGPR represents the diverse interests of the stakeholders in genetic issues, including health systems, healthcare providers, insurers, and consumers. In practical terms, this bill will facilitate the necessary and proper flow of medical information for treatment, payment, and healthcare operations. For example, under current Oregon law, a patient has to authorize each and every instance of release or information or retention of genetic information. So this means if a primary care provider sends a patient with a genetic diagnosis to a specialist for a test, the specialist must then obtain patient authorization before the results of the test can be released back to the patient's primary care provider. Senate Bill 99 proposes to remove the requirement for authorizations in these instances. This will not result in less protection of genetic information because genetic information is protected by HIPAA, federal law protecting personal information. Available to explain...
Madam Chair, I hate to bother you in the middle of your testimony, but I'm going to ask you to please clarify that. To me, what we're saying is we're going to take the state law that's more stringent, more protections, and weaken it or lower it to a standard that's at the federal level. I worked on this in 95, 97, mm-hmm. and one of the things I remember from our legislative process that we wanted to make ensure as much protection. So in your presentation, please convince me why I should go back against the standard that I've already set and agreed to, that we're going to give Oregonians the most protection as possible.
Chair Burdick and Senator Pozensky, if I can ask actually Gwen Dayton to respond. She is one of the co-chairs, and she has the detail, I think, that can address your concerns.
That'll be fine.
That, in summary, was the testimony I was presenting, so I'm comfortable deferring to Gwen.
I appreciate that, and I had the same question, so fire away.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, Senator Pozensky. I have submitted written testimony, but I think I speak for all of us at this table today that our goal is
to identify yourself.
Oh, yes, thank you. I'm Gwen Dayton, and I'm speaking today as co-chair of the Advisory Committee on Genetic Privacy and Research. And it is our goal today to help the committee understand exactly what this bill does and what it doesn't do. And so I appreciate your question, Senator Pozensky, and I will speak directly to it, and then I can cover other points that are made in my written testimony as well. The HIPAA privacy protections protect medical information generally. They indicate when disclosures can be made without permission and when they require permission. HIPAA does not distinguish between different types of medical information. It just protects what's called protected health information broadly. It establishes a floor for protection of medical records across the country. States cannot go below it. You may recall last session we spent a fair amount of time amending Oregon law to make sure we didn't go below the protections that are provided in HIPAA. States can, however, have more stringent privacy protections than HIPAA provides, and Oregon does, in the area of what we call specially protected records. genetic information is one of those specialty protected records. Some mental health records are another, some drug and alcohol, HIV are other examples of when Oregon has chosen to provide greater protections for information than HIPAA would. Let me talk, though, about the kinds of disclosures that we're talking about in this bill and why, in the view of the advisory committee, we are not substantially lessening any of the essential privacy protections that Oregonians expect related to their genetic information. Because I think that is really at the core of your question. Why should we retreat from some of the protections that we debated extensively over time?
And also why it was put there in the first place.
Right. Let me talk first about why we have this bill picks out certain disclosures for lesser protection than current law would provide. This bill allows healthcare providers and insurers who are covered entities under HIPAA, meaning that HIPAA does govern their disclosures of information. It allows those kinds of entities to retain, basically mean record, keep a record of, genetic information and disclose it for purposes of treatment of the patient, payment for services, and what are called, so we can basically, a hospital or a physician can bill, and what are called healthcare operations. And in here I list what healthcare operations is. It's a defined term in both HIPAA and Oregon law. It's defined exactly the same in Oregon law as it is in HIPAA. Essentially what it is, though, is the internal workings of a provider.
Please.
I think I'm following what you're okay. saying, but as I read the section 2.1, it says retention for the provider's own treatment.
Right.
It doesn't say the provider's own treatment of the individual. I think without that clarity, this could be very misleading.
Chairman, Senator Starr, I understand that question. That phrase, provider's own treatment, is used often, not meaning the provider's treatment. For example, a physician wouldn't retain a patient's genetic information for the physician's own healthcare needs. It's meant as for the treatment of the patient, not for the treatment of the provider. But if that is presenting an area of confusion, we're more than happy to clarify it, because what we want is clarity, and so if that presents confusion to the reader who doesn't live and breathe this every day, then we're very glad to provide that.
Thank you.
Yes. This bill would retain all of the other protections of genetic information. For example, you could not disclose genetic information to employers, life insurance, even family. All of those other protections remain. It is only those routine day-to-day uses of medical information that are very important within the context of the operation of a provider or an insurer that we allow to happen without the patient's authorization. Let me explain one of the primary motivators for what led us to where we are with this, because backing up a little bit, the advisory committee was formed to study the use and disclosure of DNA information and genetic information. And the committee itself, I know I speak for all of them, are very concerned about privacy issues. It's not we are not formed to lessen privacy protections that have been long fought for in Oregon. But the reason that we are here today with this bill is because genetic information is defined in the law very broadly to mean not just the genetic test and the result of the test, but any information obtained about an individual from the test. So what that means is if an individual was diagnosed with a condition such as Huntington's disease or cystic fibrosis years ago with a genetic test, the reference to that condition in the medical record is specially protected. And under current law, we cannot disclose that even to another provider for treatment, like a hospital that treats somebody and then they go to their community physician, could not disclose that record. They couldn't even write down technically the condition in the record without the patient's authorization. The difficulty is that the test was done years ago. Nobody even really knows at the time they're being treated that they were diagnosed with a genetic test. It commonly only surfaces later when somebody reviews the record to make sure they can disclose it, and they find, wait a minute, this disclosure requires authorization, because unlike the patient in the bed next to this one who is diagnosed symptomatically, this person is diagnosed with a test, and we cannot disclose the mere fact that they've been diagnosed with this condition without the authorization, and we can't get it at that that point. So I know hospitals.
Why can't you get it at that point?
Because the patient commonly is long gone. They've been treated. They've gone home. We can't find them to get the authorization from them.
And why do you need it at that point?
We need it to disclose it for any purpose. We need it to disclose to the treating physician. We need it to bill for services. This is what commonly comes
up. How would you need something for a patient that's long gone?
Well, long gone is probably not the right term. They're no longer in the hospital. They're no longer, the physician may no longer be able to obtain authorization from them because they're not in their presence anymore. They're not physically there, and so you have to find them and bring them back in to obtain authorization for this disclosure that is, we don't think.
So you're talking about paying claims?
Paying claims is a big part of it.
So it goes to insurers?
Right now, we are prohibited from disclosing to insurers that a person was treated genetically diagnosed condition without their authorization. So we essentially can't bill for the service if a person was treated, for example, in a hospital, but it could be a physician or other provider. We can't bill for that service without their authorization, and it's quite difficult to get that authorization by the time you're at that point.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pazansky?
I'm already tell you, my comfort level is very shaky right now.
Okay.
Based on what I'm hearing. I'm wondering a couple of things. Number one, I think the concern I'm hearing the chair says is one that I have as to one of the reasons that we put this in place and having such close scrutiny is to make certain that genetic information is not being broadcast out any further than it needs to go. So I'm not sure about the billing part as to how you get around that. But one of the things I'm wondering, Madam Chair, is why couldn't the individual providers provide to that patient basically a waiver or the ability to have that information transmitted or given to whoever might need to have that information, such as another attending physician, another provider that where the test weren't done, but they're going back to their family practitioner or whoever. Did the committee look at any other ways besides coming in and basically just changing the state law as to what could actually be accomplished through the standard patient-physician relationship and having some type of forms? I mean, there's so many forms you fill out already. What's another form that says, we will limit this, and maybe what we need to do is say what you can or can't ask for to be waived without having some other type of authority.
Senator Brzezinski, I don't recall the committee discussing precisely something like a waiver, but let me tell you what I think is the practical obstacle to what you're discussing. The difficulty is that under HIPAA, we're not required to get authorization for disclosure of medical information for treatment or billing purposes. And the difficulty is that providers don't know at the time they're treating this person that this information is any different than any other information they have in the record. So they don't have there's no red flag that says you really need to get some sort of either authorization or waiver, either one. I mean, the waiver would be just as difficult to get as the authorization because it looks like regular health information when we have it. It's only when we discover later that, wait a minute, 5 years ago there was a genetic test done on this person that diagnosed this condition. Because of that, we need to get permission to disclose for any purpose. And it's that broad definition of genetic information that covers not just the test but any treatment down the line, no matter how long that treatment may go, that poses the practical barrier to getting either authorization or waiver.
If I can follow up on that.
Please do.
What I heard, Ms. Dalton, was that the HIPAA does not require disclosure of what treatments actually provided for billing purposes.
No, Chair Senator Burdick, Senator Brzezinski, HIPAA does not require us to get patient permission, authorization, is the HIPAA term, for disclosures for billing purposes.
For disclosure to who?
For billing purposes.
For billing purposes. Mm-hmm. But the billing would still say this service or treatment or test or whatever it was conducted on this day, and please pay us for that service.
The bill itself going from a provider to an insurer typically is done by way of coding the particular diagnosis that was the primary diagnosis and their secondary diagnosis. It doesn't necessarily say, it won't reference any test at all. It'll just reference cystic fibrosis diagnosis, for example. But because that information was obtained through a genetic test, it's specially protected. So it won't talk about the genetic test at all, but it'll just bill for this particular hospitalization, 2 days for cystic fibrosis treatment. That's a little bit simplified.
So you're not talking about test results. You're talking about the fact that a test was done?
And the test was done.
Chair Burdick, it could be both. Under the way this is written, we can disclose genetic information without patient permission for purposes of treatment and payment and healthcare operations. So what that means is we could disclose for billing purposes, for example, because that's what we're talking about. Typically, it's going to be treatment of a condition that was diagnosed with a test long ago. But it also could be the fact that the test was billing for the test itself, because that would fall under the definition of genetic information. It's not that test itself that we're the most concerned about, because the person's right there, and if you want us to get authorization for that disclosure, I don't think that providers or insurers would be bothered by that. It's the down-the-road treatment that we're, practically speaking, prevented from getting authorization for that is the biggest problem.
I'm listening to it. How do you do it now? What happens now?
Chair Burdick, what happens now is we don't bill for the service typically. We just don't get paid. If we can't get authorization, and we're trying our best to comply with the law as it's written, then we would not be able to bill for the service or to disclose to the community provider or do internal operations like peer review and things like that with the data, because it's protected.
I mean, it seems like we're in a catch-22 here, because what I'm hearing is that you can actually, or the billing actually goes for providing some type of treatment for whatever these symptoms or whatever the diagnosis is, and that's all. You don't go into all the details. So that would tell me that you should be able to bill for it, but then I'm hearing that you can't actually issue the bill because you could potentially be giving some information to the insurer that this service or this patient has some condition that was found through a genetic test or process, and that's part of the reasons why we put these safeguards in, that the patient would not have that information disclosed without their consent and authorization.
Yeah, Chair Burdick, Senator Pruszynski, the disparity we end up with is that you can have a condition that was diagnosed with a genetic test that we can't bill for, but the same condition may have been diagnosed without a test by pursuant to symptoms, and we could bill for that. So that's the disparity we find ourselves in. And on the other end of things, that I'm a little bit less, my depth of knowledge is less in the insurance area, frankly, but insurance folks need to be able to say whether the treatment that was provided was medically necessary and go through their claims evaluation process as well. And they get a very redacted record now if they get anything at all from the hospital that takes out all the genetic information. So they don't really get the full scope of service that was provided to the patient. So that's the difficulty that we both find.
I guess what we're struggling here with is, okay, so you give the information to the insurance company. The insurance company takes a look at it and says, we're not insuring this person anymore.
Chair Burdick, Senator Pruszynski, the committee spent a lot of time on that because we share that concern. We have absolutely no interest in diminishing any or adding to the ability of any health insurer to prevent insurance or to jack up the rate using the vernacular. And so we had the insurance division come in and talk to the advisory committee about what existing protections there are in law right now preventing that kind of use, because we would never go down that road if it could be used for that purpose. And there are existing laws, and I mentioned them at the last page of my written testimony, that prevent use of genetic information for discriminatory purposes. In group health insurance, you can't use a health statement at all. In individual health insurance, there's a law that says you cannot discriminate based on genetic information. There's also a law that says you have to use a particular health statement, and that health statement has been revised in the last few months to make sure that genetic information cannot be used. So we thought long and hard about that and felt that there were existing laws that prevented use of the information.
Yeah, but there's a million reasons that an insurer could come up with. I think that's what our concern is. I'm like Senator Pruszynski, I'm listening, but I'm still. Council, did you have some input?
Well, Chair, members of the committee, I have over about 4.5-5 pages of emails on many of the same questions that you've gone over. And one of the parts that I had difficulty with was on Section 5 on page 3, and it talks about a health insurer may retain genetic information of individual without obtaining an authorization from the individual, the person representing the individual, if retention is for the insurer's own treatment, payment, or health care operations. A little reading of that, I don't think insurance companies are into treatment.
I
looked at the statute as it relates to the definition of healthcare operations, and some of their activities do are covered in there. And I could see payment, but I've been struggling myself with the idea of what do you mean by treatment in that context.
Chair Burdick, Mr. Taylor, the reason it's written that way is because last session in 2003, when we revised the insurance code as well as other laws in light of HIPAA, the HIPAA language, treatment, payment, healthcare operations, was reiterated in the insurance code, even though I agree, because that's the way HIPAA is written, even though I agree that insurers don't really engage in treatment, and to put that in there is confusing. But it's in there that way because, and I'm not the drafter, and perhaps you may want to speak with Holly Robinson on the issue, but I imagine the reason it's written that way is because that Section 5 is made part of the insurance code, made part of the series that is written in that way, and so it was written to be consistent with other verbiage in the statutes. But you're right, insurers don't do treatment. They're not providers. To some extent, we can go down the road of talking about disease management and whether that's treatment, but I don't think that you want to do that today. But their most important functions using genetic information would be payment and healthcare operations. And it is true that healthcare operations, as defined, includes underwriting, which should make everybody sit up and go, well, wait a minute, we don't want them to underwrite based on genetic information. But there are existing statutes in Oregon that prevent use of genetic information to adversely underwrite.
Okay, what is your best estimate of how much billing money is lost every year or last year or whatever time period you want to pick from inability to hunt down the person to give authorization?
Sure, but that's a good question, then I'll have to find out expressly for you. I can tell you that hospital representatives came to the advisory committee with this as a significant concern. If you would like me to get some particular numbers on that, I'm very glad to.
I appreciate that.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, why don't you wrap up the comments that you wanted to make, and we'll continue on through the list.
I think Chair Burdick, frankly, expressed most of my comments that are in my written testimony. I think the most important point I'd like to leave you with is that the existing genetic privacy laws in Oregon serve a very important function, and this advisory committee in no way wanted to limit those protections. But the way that the term genetic information is used presents significant barriers to just routine disclosures within a provider typically, and also insurer, that we don't believe as an advisory committee the patient would find objectionable. In fact, the limitations on disclosures are actually limiting the ability of a hospital or a physician or others to provide care to the patient, because we can't let anybody else, we can't even write down in the record what they're diagnosed with, much less give it to somebody else to treat them. And so we think that actually those barriers to patient care are significant enough that, and patients would want those disclosures to be made. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions for Katie? Thank you. We hear from you now. Thank you.
Chair Burdick and members, my name is Emily Harris, and I'm also representing the Advisory Committee on Genetic Privacy and Research. And I don't have a lot to add to what my colleague Gwen Dayton has, but I would like to just say a few comments. My main concern as well is in the committees is making sure that people can get the health care they need while their privacy is also protected. And one of the things that the legislature asked us to do as part of our work before this legislative session was to look at simplifying whether the law could be simplified in light of the implementation of HIPAA. So HIPAA had not been implemented the last time we were here in front of you. So when asked why the change, part of it is looking at what HIPAA offers, what's been learned in the years since it's been implemented, since 2003. And so we thought that the privacy protections that HIPAA provided met the goals of the committee in protecting the public's privacy and confidentiality while still being able to address the concerns, the general concern of people being able to get adequate health care. And another, I think another essential element of HIPAA, people are concerned about what might be shared. And one of the stipulations in HIPAA is that what can be shared is what's the minimum necessary information to provide treatment payment or healthcare operations. So there is a standard in HIPAA about what can be shared. And then I would like to emphasize as well that there in Oregon state law there already are protections against using genetic information in underwriting, in information of the person themselves or their family members. So that in conjunction with the protections that HIPAA provides, we thought were good protections for the public.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We will hear now from Ted Falk and Betsy Earls. Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ted Falk, and for the record, I'm employed by the Oregon Department of Justice, but I appear here today as a private citizen and not on behalf of the DOJ. I have studied health law issues my entire career, and I was part of the group that wrote this legislation. Legislation was drafted in 1994 and went through the legislature in 1995, and then I've been part of the various advisory committees that have examined this legislation since that time. I guess I want to make two main points and then maybe just be available to the committee council and to the committee for any sort of technical work they want to do. The first point that I wanted to make is about HIPAA. HIPAA did not exist in 1995. Actually, the federal statute that authorized HIPAA was enacted in 1995, but the rules themselves didn't come into effect until a number of years later. So at the time that the genetic privacy law was written, there was not any sort of comprehensive statute, either at the federal or state level, regulating privacy of medical records. I think that the statute would have been, the genetic privacy statute would have been drafted very differently had HIPAA been in place at the time. And so one of the tasks that we have had in recent years has been trying to figure out how to integrate the Oregon statute with HIPAA. And let me just add a little bit of what was just said about what HIPAA does that we didn't have when the statute was first enacted. HIPAA defines a group of what are called covered entities, which are basically health care providers and health insurance companies. And they are subject to a very stringent level of protection. And actually, one comment characterization that I wouldn't entirely agree with that was made in the preceding testimony is to say that HIPAA is less protective of patient privacy. Actually, in many ways, HIPAA is more protective of patient privacy than the Oregon statute because HIPAA is very lengthy, it's very detailed, it anticipates all kinds of circumstances that we couldn't possibly have anticipated in the Oregon genetic privacy law. But in some regards, HIPAA is more protective. In some regards, the genetic privacy law is more protective.
But legally speaking, that can't be. If Oregon protections must be at least as protective or more protective. I mean, that's federal law. This is supremacy cost.
That's correct. HIPAA preempts any state laws which are less protective, but it allows more protective. So the parts of the Oregon genetic privacy law which are more protective than HIPAA remain in effect.
We have laws on HIPAA in Oregon that are not enforceable because they're less protective?
My main point was that before HIPAA was enacted, the law in Oregon protecting medical information privacy was very weak and very scattered. As a result of the enactment of HIPAA, there is now a comprehensive federal law protecting medical privacy of health information for providers and health insurance companies. That law was then incorporated into Oregon state law in 2003. We can call it a mini HIPAA law, which generally speaking tracks the federal law. So there is this foundation in HIPAA that today exists and appears to be a permanent part of the privacy landscape that did not exist in 1995. So I think part of our deliberation is what makes sense for those entities that are covered by HIPAA. Let's remember that other entities, like employers, are not covered in any fashion by HIPAA, and the Oregon Generic Privacy Law would remain in effect for those. So I think the thinking of the committee was what is added by way of privacy protection for individuals if we keep a dual layer of protection, that is the state generic privacy law versus HIPAA. And I think we came to the conclusion that as to medical providers and health insurance companies, that the HIPAA protection was adequate and we didn't need, at least with regard to the core functions of treatment, payment, and healthcare operations, add a second layer of protection. I think it's important to realize that if a disclosure without authorization is made to an insurance company, say, they are still restricted by HIPAA on what further use they can make on it. So it's actually very highly restricted in a number of ways. They can't just sort of broadcast it. They can only use it for the purposes that HIPAA allows, plus there are some further points. Let me just turn now very quickly to my second main point, which is about insurance protection. The committee actually has recommended a couple of pieces of legislation, and due to the sponsorship and sequencing, only this one is appearing before you today. But the other piece of legislation, which is described in our report to the legislature, and which I'm hoping we'll find a sponsor soon, would actually add to the protections against discrimination in employment and insurance. So the insurance in the specific areas where we thought that the insurance discrimination protections were inadequate, we did strengthen them. So we really view these bills as somewhat of a package, in the sense that this bill would streamline what you might call everyday insurance operations, and the other bill would strengthen the insurance protections with regard to insurers' use of information for underwriting other purposes. So that's what I wanted to say to you. I'll be happy to address any technical questions, or if there's any follow-up, I'll be happy to be involved.
Senator Pruzanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Paul, the last point that you made is to the second bill. You made reference that you're looking for a sponsor. Is the bill actually a bill, or is it still a concept to be drafted as a bill?
There's actually language that the committee prepared. I don't believe it has. I'm not aware that it has an official sponsor in the legislature. It's not a bill in the official sense of an LC. It is a bill in the sense that there's a draft which we could share with you.
That would be wonderful if you could share that with the committee. Mm-hmm. And if I could follow up one other.
Please.
The other question is, it seems like we have now all of a sudden this problem since HIPAA's come in place since 2003. At least that's what the review is looking at. Can you tell me, from your understanding, how the billing took place from 1995 when we put these protections in to 2003?
What happened between 1995 and 2003?
Yeah, I'm hearing now that we can't bill insurance for these services. So we've had this in place since 1995, and so I'm trying to figure out, how's everyone getting by for the last 8 years?
Well, a piece of legislation like this is not self-implementing. It requires a tremendous amount of education and requires people. When it was enacted in 1995, I think a lot of people weren't even aware of it for a number of years. So I would honestly say that I don't think every aspect of the bill was followed when it was first enacted. Now, increasingly, there has been education about the law, and I think part of the reason why this is only coming up now is that because of HIPAA, hospitals and health insurance companies are putting tremendous amounts of staff and resources in reviewing their policies for privacy of information, whereas in 1995 that was a neglected stepchild. So I think a piece of legislation like this can be enacted in 1995, but there can be a lot of sort of casual observance of it. Now there are professional staff at every hospital and insurance company who are very attentive. They are called the institution's privacy official, and although the existence of that official is required by HIPAA, they also take as their portfolio looking at all the other privacy laws that exist. And so I think one of the beneficial side effects of HIPAA was the creation of a whole new layer of staff and policy that were devoted to privacy issues. So I think this was a little bit of a sleeper as far as a lot of hospitals and insurance companies, and many of them discovered that they weren't in compliance with it, and then their own HIPAA officials would say, wait a minute, we're not doing everything we needed to. And then, so I think that the fact that this bill is coming up now to some extent reflects the fact that people are finally trying to figure out how can they comply with it.
Candid answer. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Burdick and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Betsy Earls representing Kaiser Permanente. And because Kaiser is a little bit unique in Oregon and other states in terms of its relationship between providers, health plan, hospital, and those groups, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about our support of Senate Bill 99. Kaiser Permanente is an integrated health care delivery system, and we're licensed as a health care services contractor in Oregon. I think the integrated nature of Kaiser is the unique facet of our operations, in that we combine the delivery and financing of health care services for our members. Members of Kaiser receive a broad range of prepaid health care services, including hospital care, professional care in hospitals and medical offices, x-ray and laboratory services, ambulance services, preventative services, health care education, dental services, and even prescription drugs. Our physicians work under exclusive contracts with Kaiser and generally don't provide services to non-members. So it's a little bit of a closed system, if you will. Similarly, our insurance branch, which is called Health Plan, does not cover any non-Kaiser members. Because of our integrated nature, Kaiser's Health Plan performs certain work for the provider branch or the physicians that providers in many cases would deal with on their own. Much of this work is related to or makes use of genetic information, and it includes things like quality assessment and improvement activities, help with outcomes evaluation, creation of clinical guidelines, population-oriented education activities, protocol development, help with care management and coordination, evaluation of provider performance, and also some training, accreditation, and certification and licensing activities. All of these activities fall under HIPAA's definition of healthcare operations, which, as you heard earlier, is one of three purposes for which the law allows information to be retained without specific case-by-case authorization. And as you also already heard, the other two purposes are for treatment and payment. HIPAA does not provide protections specific to these disclosures, but patients are, as I'm sure you have all noticed, notified prior to treatment when you go into your doctor's or a hospital and are asked to sign an authorization, which you'll notice is generally titled Notice of Privacy Practices or something like that. And in 2003, Oregon passed the companion law to the new federal HIPAA privacy regulations that we've discussed. And for the most part, Oregon law does mirror the key provisions of HIPAA. However, we require patient authorization for routine retention and disclosure of genetic information in situations where HIPAA does not require that. Retention is defined as making a medical record. So that includes writing something down in a patient's chart. And that means that under current law, technically speaking, hospitals and doctors are not allowed to record that type of information in a patient's chart. For practical purposes, I think that information usually is recorded, but then if it's passed on to perhaps the health plan side of Kaiser, it's redacted. And that's part of the problem that we're dealing with, is an extensive need for redaction before information is moved between different entities within Kaiser. I'd say that's one of the prime difficulties that Kaiser has had with the law as it stands right now, and one of the things that Senate Bill 99 would fix in terms of routine business practices between entities. In the last few days, I think that you've all heard there have been different conversations surrounding the idea that insurers should maybe only be allowed to retain genetic information without authorization for purposes of treatment or purposes of payment, perhaps removing the definition of healthcare operations from language infecting insurers. And the point I'd like to make is that because of the blended operations that we have at Kaiser Permanente, that would be a serious disadvantage to our company. That's my testimony, and to the extent that you intend to work further on the bill, I'd be happy to work with them.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick, just one short question. Certainly, complete medical records, including all that genetic information, would be required in the physician's medical record, I would think, by law. So are you saying that the Kaiser Permanente then requires two sets of records, one the real record and one for the insurance because of this law?
As it gets sent over to the insurance side, information is heavily redacted, yes.
So basically you're required to make a dual record system.
Senator Burdick, Senator Whitsitt, that is generally the practical effect, okay. Yes.
But why don't you just get an authorization from the patient to...
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we do get a general authorization, but the problem is that technically speaking, Oregon law requires a specific authorization for every single disclosure. And so to cover that problem, what we end up doing is a lot of black lining and marking out.
Madam Chair. Ms. Earls, in your statement to Senator Whitsitt, you keep two sets of records. The reality is you keep two sets of records no matter what. One set is going to stay with the doc. The other is going to go for the billing purposes or whatever other portion. And that set, it's either going to be a complete set or it's going to be a redacted set, but you're keeping two sets, aren't you?
Madam Chair, I think that Senator Przanski, that's correct. It ends up to be two. Well, it's always going to be two sets, but
right.
It's two different sets.
That's right.
And that can be a problem.
Well, you say that could be a problem. Maybe for Kaiser, it wouldn't seem to be. I mean, to me, one of the issues that we tried to address was that we didn't have free flow of genetic information going from point A to point B. What I'm hearing is potentially maybe Kaiser uses the medical side of the records in the billing, and maybe they have more of a transparency between those two entities as compared to a doctor's office that's independent from the billing side of the insurer part. But what the concerns I remember that we addressed in 95 and we've kept up until this point is that we are going to be very strict on allowing for genetic information of an individual to be released without their authorization. And that's what I think is the reason why you're seeing the redacted records. But you're still... I mean, If your insurance side of Kaiser does not have a complete set, are they going over to the medical side and saying, let us borrow your medical records so we can use those?
No, Madam Chair and Senator Przanski, absolutely not.
Great.
They're redacted for a reason.
Excellent.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I must admit I'm completely stumped by this bill at this point. So are there other questions from the committee?
I would just like to say that I very much appreciate the line of questioning you're subjecting us to, because I think you're asking exactly the right question, and it is, are we maintaining an appropriate level of protection for genetic information? I mean, that's the core question.
We'd be interested in seeing the draft that you have on this other bill, and also the information on how serious the problem this is, how much money is being lost by not being able to bill for things. And also, are there people on your genetic, probably should know this, but on the Genetic Privacy Committee who are specifically there because they represent the interests of privacy rather than health providers?
Yes, consumers are one of the sort of the statutory classes of members on the committee.
Okay, it would be very helpful to hear from some of them on this issue.
Yeah, and ACLU is also represented on the committee.
Senator Przanski.
Madam Chair, Mr. Falk, I think the other thing that would be beneficial for me is we broached the subject a little bit today as to why we couldn't use authorizations or some type of waiver. I'd like a little bit more information as to what the committee, if anything, was discussed. I know Ms. Dayton said that it's kind of maybe was talked about, but maybe not in great detail. But it just seems to me that's a way that you may be able to get it. Of course, my preference would be that it be very strictly narrow for certain purposes and that certain information comes across. But it's almost like we're ringing the bell no matter what, because even with the redacted copies of medical reports, someone's on the insurance side saying, oh boy, we know what this means. And, the concern is that and somehow being used against the patient later in rating, billing, or whatever it might be. It may not be happening, but it's one of those things that I think, knowing what the intent of the legislature was in 95, and I guess I have the title of the only freshman from the House of Representatives that was here since 1995, and I know what we went through in judiciary. We really had a lot of concern about having that opened up, and I just seem like we're looking at maybe putting a wedge in what the intent was, and I'm going to need some really strong testimony as to why that needs to be done as compared to maintaining what we established in 95.
Okay. Well, I think we've given direction on what kind of information we need to see. For the meantime, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 99, and we will open... I think we'll do 372. And I think we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 372.
Okay.
Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 372, sponsored by Senator Walker and Gordley, increases the penalty for failure to report child abuse, abuse in long-term residential care facility, abuse of a person 65 or older, or abuse of a person who is mentally ill, developmentally disabled, to a Class A misdemeanor. Authorizes suspension of any professional license of a private or public official for failure to report abuse.
Thank you. We have Vicki. We have Senator Walker here to introduce this bill.
Madam Chair, what I also forgot to mention is the dash one and dash two amendments.
Senator Walker, you'll discuss the dash one and dash two amendments in your presentation, correct? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator for District 7. The dash one and the dash twos are both mine. This is a little bill, and it's been very, very difficult for me to get my hands around it in a way that makes everyone happy, that gets at the crux of the matter and solves the problem I'm trying to solve. Madam Chair, as you know, with my history, I'm very, very concerned about child abuse, sex abuse, elder abuse, all of those things, as all of you are. This last year, as we all know, a former governor in the state was exposed as being a pedophile. So that whole issue brought it out for me again and told me that this is a conspiracy of silence, that we need to solve it, and I'm not sure how we're going to get there, but I dove in head first, and I'm trying to make sense of the best way to get what I need done. I have Senate Bill 749 and Senate Bill 755 that came out of my education committee that Senator Starr voted on. Those get at teachers and reporting and training and disclosure of records of convicted sex abusers who are teachers or school administrators or any other school personnel. This bill needs to go a little bit broader. This bill has to do with the mandatory reporters. If you don't know, which I think all of you do, legislators are mandatory reporters. I could ask you if you've ever been trained as a mandatory reporter. I suspect that the only one on this panel that would answer in the affirmative is Senator Pozonsky and Senator Ringo, because they are lawyers, and lawyers, as part of their training, have to be trained in how to be a mandatory reporter. Colleagues, you are a mandatory reporter. Have you ever received training on how to be a mandatory reporter? I think not. I've never received training. I am a survivor of child sex abuse. I would probably recognize it, but I wouldn't be able to tell you. I could probably recognize elder financial abuse, but there are other subtle signs that I wouldn't be able to know. And before we leave this building and Sine Die this year, I hope the Center President allows me to make the request that all of us get training in how to be a mandatory reporter. It's all well and good when you keep adding people to the law that says you shall be a mandatory reporter, but it doesn't do a hill of beans when we don't offer the tools to be a mandatory reporter. This bill addresses the issue of failure to report. The failure to report is right now just a Class A violation. It's, I believe, a $750 fine. It's really nothing. And frankly, I got an email from a sex crimes investigator here in Salem who worked on one of these more recent cases, and he told me in his, how many years? In his umpteen years, I have never seen a single prosecution for failure to report in either Marion or Polk County. The reason is, it's not really a prosecutable offense, or at least it doesn't land in the hierarchy of things that we need to prosecute because we don't have the money, we don't have the time. Frankly, I think it needs to be elevated to the top of the list. Let me just briefly go through a couple of cases for you. Well, first of all, I want to read from you the Parade magazine, August 22, 2004, an article by Andrew Vakas, who's a lawyer, and his only clients are children, abused children. Why do the media promote the image of child victims as participants in the crimes committed against them? A former governor of Oregon recently admitted to repeated sexual abuse of a 14-year-old girl. The state's major newspaper reported this series of ongoing crimes as a, quote, relationship, unquote, and characterized the conduct as an affair, quote, unquote. This would be much more shocking were it not so common. It is common, colleagues. It's shamefully common. In September of 2004, the Veneta congregation had to deal with sex abuse. A music minister raped a 14-year-old girl in the congregation. What was so shocking is that when the reverend of the church discovered that members of the church hierarchy knew of the rape, concealed it from him, and continued to conceal it from police, and they were pressuring the victim to do likewise, he did what every reasonable person would do. He turned it into the police. The case proceeded. The man was eventually sentenced and copped a plea of some kind. But what happened is the reverend got so much pressure from the bishop of the church that they closed the church. They closed the church, and this reverend resigned. And you know what? The people who should have reported, nothing is happening to those people. Not one lousy thing. In February of this year, we had a report in Oregon Live, in the Oregonian, teacher Linda Verdin. She remembers Ashley Pond telling her when Ward Weaver tried to rape her, and their naive certainty that once Verdin reported Ashley's story to the Clackamas County Child Welfare Office that someone was going to rein in this monster. Well, we all know that didn't happen. We all know what happened in that case. This woman quit her teaching job. She can't function anymore because the system let her down. We have another case of Jordan Knapp. I think this was the same newspaper. This was February 19th, 2 days later. We had Jordan Knapp, a young 6-year-old girl who had been starved and malnourished while in foster care. Gary Weeks, director of the State Department of Human Services, said, clearly, we found we weren't following our own practices. One of the critical response teams assessments was that they said, well, we didn't expect anyone to be cited for failing to report abuse, which can carry a fine. Who knows what's coming out of that? Additionally, on the same day, there was an op-ed piece by Liberty House here in Salem. They said, prevention is the key to a safer future for our children. Prevention. Reporting abuse. The Bolera case in the Salem-Kaiser School District. Western Oregon University, harassment. I could just fill you with lots of lists and stories about cases of child abuse, probably more less so about elder abuse because we haven't seen as many reportings. But the point is, Madam Chair, there's not enough of a stick for people to do their job as a mandatory reporter. Now, what I wanted to do in this bill, after I got to thinking about it, was to change it so that all mandatory reporters had to have mandatory training on how to be a mandatory reporter. Unfortunately, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill has such a narrow relating clause, sometimes that comes back to bite you, but I can't do it in this bill. I can't do it. So that's what gets me to the dash one and the dash twos, Madam Chair. The dash one takes out all reference to revocation or suspension of license, and it merely leaves in the increase in the penalty. This is the least favored option, but it takes out the revocation and suspension, which was really freaking a lot of people out.
And it remains a Class A misdemeanor.
It does, Madam Chair. I was not willing to reduce that. And I actually patterned this bill after a similar law in Illinois, Madam Chair. It's the same exact law in Illinois. Other states, Mississippi, for instance, failure to report is punishable by a year in jail and $5,000 fine. And there were a number of other states that had different varying penalties. The Dash 2 Amendment is my attempt to get at the mandatory reporting, Madam Chair. The Dash 2 Amendment says that upon conviction of a crime of failure to report, the court will order you to complete a mandatory training course. If you fail to complete a mandatory training course, your license is subject to suspension or revocation. The mandatory training course will be paid by your employer. The appointing authority, because some of the mandatory reporters do not have an employer, or it will be paid by your licensing agency. This is the only way I could get to it, Madam Chair. This is the best that I could do. I know some people signed up in opposition to the bill, but I don't know if they signed up in opposition to the original bill. I want a discussion, Madam Chair. We all want a discussion. We've got to stop the conspiracy of silence and stop the abuse of our children and our elderly people.
Can I interrupt for a second, Senator Walker? I think what we'll do is we'll have copies made of the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments because they're separate amendments. The Dash 2 doesn't incorporate Dash 1. Is that correct?
Well, the Dash 2 still, no.
Okay.
They're separate amendments.
Separate amendments.
We have one or the other, but they still, Madam Chair, have a Class A misdemeanor as their violation.
So we will have copies made and put on the table for people.
Oh, they're not out here?
They were in the district.
We had such a rush for them, Madam Chair.
They were going fast in the office, so we'll take care of getting more copies put out there.
All right. Well, Madam Chair, I know there are some other people to visit with. I've been speaking with Judge Edward Jones of Multnomah County. He agreed with me that but mandatory training was really the important thing. Just increasing penalties, he didn't feel was working. And then when I got back to him with my last amendment, he still has concerns about that because he wants mandatory training. We can't get there in this bill. I'm happy, Madam Chair, I have one priority bill remaining. I would be happy to use a priority bill because I'm really going to have trouble finding a bill with a relating clause. The relating clause has to be relating to abuse or relating to abuse reporting. But I'm not going to go to the mat on my priority bill if people aren't there with me on this mandatory training. The issues to worry about with regard to that is who's going to pay for it and who's going to administer it. And I asked Timothy Travis today to come and talk to you about training for mandatory reporters because he does that. And he does a very good job of it from what I've heard. So I'll just have the discussion, Madam Chair, if you don't mind. I know that all of you care about this issue as much as I do. And just getting a handle on it is just, it's really hard. And I just want to take the first step here. And that's why I'm here.
Thank you very much, Senator Walker. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. And I would remind the audience that the amendments that Senator Walker referred to are on the table. And it's kind of a short notice. I know sometimes we don't get these amendments with very much advance notice, but to the extent that people are testifying, if they could testify to the amendment, to the specific amendments, that would be very helpful. I think we'll take Timothy Travis next to talk about some of the training issues. Oh, it looks like we've got our own training packet now. Is that correct?
All of them. Amendments aren't out there yet.
It's there.
No, Mr. Bishop just said they're not.
Madam Chair, I would just say I didn't get these amendments until yesterday afternoon.
I didn't mean to point any fingers because I know that you were very good about getting them to me right away.
Right, and I appreciate Legislative Council getting that out as quickly as they did.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much, and welcome to the committee.
My name is Timothy Travis. You all know me as the Court Improvement Manager of the Oregon Judicial Department. I am not here today in that official capacity as an employee of the Oregon Judicial Department, nor am I speaking for the department, nor am I speaking for the judges. I am speaking in my own personal capacity as an attorney whose specialty is child abuse and neglect law and who has, as the Senator said, done extensive training on the Mandatory Child Abuse Reporting Act. As the good senator said, it is very difficult to make people happy around the issue of mandatory child abuse reporting training, mostly because they don't want to do it. I do mandatory training for lawyers, judges, I've done it for CASAs, I've done it for all the various players in the child abuse and neglect system. I am embarking upon a new career of doing mandatory child abuse reporting for the Oregon Youth Authority. I'm doing the first one on Friday. I started out with the lawyers in 2000 or so when it became mandatory for lawyers to be trained. Lawyers are required to receive 1 hour of training on mandatory child abuse reporting every 3 years. So every January, one-third of the attorneys practicing in Oregon must report to the bar that they have had an hour's worth of training like the training that I do. The bar also does training. The Oregon's Bar Association. Lawyers. I'm sorry.
Travis, can I take your material, read it for an hour, and get my hours training credit for CLE?
You're out of order, Senator Persansky. Please continue.
You're going to have to take that up with the people at the MCLE.
I just reported, so I've got 3 years to get the next hour.
Okay. However, in response to one of the things that the senator said, lawyers pay for their own training. It's part of a continuing legal education program. They pay tuition to go to a training, so they pay for their training. As I say, every 3 years in January, one third of the lawyers have to report that they've had this training. You would not believe how popular I become as a speaker in December of every year. And I enjoy the popularity. There's three objectives to the training that I give, and I've given you materials that I use. The two that look identical, these are PowerPoint slides. If you look at the first slide on the first page, you'll see that one says mandatory child abuse reporting, and the other says mandatory child abuse reporting for lawyers. And there is a difference, because lawyers have issues of confidentiality in terms of clients and privilege and things like that, which interplay with the child abuse statutes and the duty to report. Other people don't have those particular issues. Physicians have a different set of issues because they have also privilege and things like that. The one that says mandatory child abuse reporting, this I have prepared for the OIA training, and it does not contain anything about privilege because they don't have any privileges. There's three things I try to do with my training. The first is I try to present in a clear and concise way exactly what we know for sure about mandatory child abuse reporting, about the how, the when, and the where. The second thing I try to do is I try to discuss the gray areas, the ambiguities and the vagaries in the statute, because there are serious vagaries and ambiguities in the statute. I know that each and every one of you, before you go to bed each night, you try to read a chapter of the ORS. I would invite you tonight to turn your attention to ORS 419B005, the Mandatory Child Abuse Reporting Act, and just read through there. I think when you do that, you will become concerned because you will ask yourself, what precisely does this mean? And if you take the handout on lawyers training that I gave you and look on page 4, you'll see that there is a, in the bottom left-hand corner, there's a slide that says, analysis of duty come into contact with. When one of the things that trips your duty to report is that you come into contact with either a child who's been abused or someone who has done the abusing. What does it mean to come into contact with someone? Is it merely that you meet them on the street? Is it that you shake their hand? Is it that you talk to them on the telephone? That is an unsettled question. So as you analyze your duty to report child abuse, you may have to make some kind of judgment about whether or not you've come into contact with that person. A second vagary is on page 5. In the bottom right-hand corner, it says, what is child abuse anyway? Abuse means negligent treatment or maltreatment of a child, including but not limited to the failure to provide adequate food, shelter, clothing, medical care that is likely to endanger the health or welfare of the child. That's really gray. I know that all of you can think of circumstances in which you may have some hesitant feelings about children that you run into in regard to those things. And no one knows for sure where that line is in terms of do you have to report or not. The last one that I want to point out to you is on the next page, page 6, in the upper left-hand corner, where it talks about abuse means threatened harm to a child, which means neglecting or subjecting a child to a substantial risk of harm to the child's health or welfare. There's a subjective call. Now, Mrs. Travis would tell you that allowing her daughters to play football probably is a mandatory child abuse reporting incident, because she feels very strongly that football substantially endangers children. So you have some vagaries and some gray areas. And we talk about this in the training. We try to give people an approach to think about how to analyze these questions. The third thing that I try to do in the training is I try to sell the audience. I try to convince them that this is not only a training about the benefits of about mandatory child abuse reporting and the benefit that it has for children, but it's also a training about our entire child protection agency. I very much appreciate the senator's concern about this issue. This is my lifelong passion, protecting children. I think we really need to begin with quality training for everyone who is a mandatory child abuse reporter. I know that you probably have not received that training. I would hate to see you on the grill for a criminal penalty when you didn't really know what it was that you were supposed to do or how you were supposed to do it. I checked through the Oregon Judicial Information Network about the number of prosecutions that there have been under this act, and Origin tells me that there have been fewer than 5. This has been a crime for a lot of years. Fewer than 5.
Mr. Travis, does Origin keep track of violations?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes, it does. Anything that's charged as a criminal act is kept track of in Origin.
Okay. No.
So it's not used as the penalty is not used. And I think one of the things that I'm trying to impress upon people in my OIA trainings is that this is a new day, that people care about this in a way that they haven't cared about it before. Because you'll notice in my slide for the OIA presentation, I mentioned the fact that this very bill is up and that people are caring about this in a way that they've not cared about it before. But the real thing here is not the penalty, because there's always been, since I've started doing this, there's always been an open question as to whether or not someone who is a mandatory reporter, if they fail to report, whether they might not be personally liable in a civil suit to the victim for not reporting. If you have a duty to report and you don't report, you fail to break the chain of causation. That means if the abuse goes on, you may be responsible for damage that's done in the interim. That's not just my theory. There was a case filed in Oregon against an attorney who failed to report. And the PLF, the Professional Liability Fund, the people who do our malpractice, they paid that claim because they didn't want that case to go to court and establish once and for all that there was civil liability. Two such cases were paid. So there's always been kind of a heavy penalty out there in the minds of lawyers. I don't know that penalty's really been transmitted to other people, but lawyers are now very aware of this. So that's what I have to say. If you have any questions, I'd be pleased to answer them.
Well, you mentioned the private right of action, and there is an immunity provision in the mandatory reporting. Are you saying that the immunity applies to people who report, but it doesn't help people who fail to report?
That's correct. The immunity applies to you if you make a report and you have reasonable cause to believe that the abuse has occurred, and if you're in good faith with your report, then you are immune from any kind of liability. If you fail to make the report, you're not immune.
Counsel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was in a hearing on this similar issue, I think, 8 years ago, when a Salem law firm testified before the committee. At that time, we were looking at issues of third-party liability. And the facts in this case were that they had a woman come to the office and say, I want to get a divorce. Do you mind if I bring in my friend? They brought it, introduced her to an associate. The associate made a mistake by saying yes, and that dissolved the attorney-client privilege. She said, my husband is having an affair with an underage girl. She was wrong, he was having an affair with two underage girls. There was a duty, because there was no protection under the attorney-client privilege, a duty for them to report. They did not report. Subsequently, the two girls' parents, sued the perpetrator. He was in prison. They also sued the two law firms. And from what we heard from testimony, they settled out of court for $600,000.
That was the case to which I alluded earlier.
Thank you very much.
And I would like to say one more thing, however. I think the senator's idea is a good one. I think that we need to address all of the mandatory abuse reporting statutes in a comprehensive way, because you have different lists of mandatory reporters for child abuse than you have for elder abuse, and that you have for abuse of the mentally disturbed and developmentally delayed. Lawyers are on the list for some, not on the list for others. The duty as to child abuse is a duty 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. In other words, it's not just when you're being a lawyer. It's all the time. Your duty is all the time, not just when you're being a legislator. That's not true of elder abuse. Elder abuse, the duty arises only when you see it in the course of your duties. And I think we need to do some work on making those kinds of things consistent. So,
Senator Walker?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Travis, you've seen this book, What You Can Do About Child Abuse, I'm sure, produced by the Department of Human Services. And on page 12, it says stresses of reporting abuse. And then it says, why don't people report suspected abuse? There are many reasons why people do not report. The first one on the list, the very first one at the top of the list, many reporters have received little or no training about the symptoms of abused children. They are uncomfortable making such a serious accusation without more background in the field of child abuse and neglect. And then number two, some people are afraid of reprisals or being sued. This is all what you've just been talking about, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is.
And even the department recognizes that, and we're still stuck in a rut, not sure how to get out. And that's what we're doing here, Madam Chair. And Mr. Travis talked about his training for the Oregon Youth Authority, and I want to take this moment to say that Mr. Lemon and Mr. Jester came into my office last week, and they told me that the Oregon Youth Authority, on its own, without any direction from the governor or anyone else, on its own, has asked Mr. Travis to come in and train all of its employees within the next 60 days, even if they've received training before on sex abuse, child abuse, because of the incidents that they've had and have been published recently. So I just want to commend the department for taking that initiative, because there's a lot of us in this building who are very frustrated that this happened. And I just want to put it on the record that they've done that. And thank you, Mr. Travis.
I'd just like to leave the committee with what I always tell people in the training. If you think you might have a situation that you should report, report it. Just report it, okay? Because the people at DHS have got nothing better to do than wait for your report, right? Lines are open. No, I'm kidding. But the point is that reports are cumulative. When you make a report, a little piece of information goes into the system. And that may be added to a little piece of information that comes into the system from someone else. And over a period of time, a pattern may emerge that your report alone wouldn't trigger help for this family. But when you put them all together, it will. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, next we have Julie McFarland, Bob Jundiff, and Martin Taylor. I'd like you to ask you two things, to focus on the amendments to the extent that you're able, and also to keep your comments very short, because we have quite a lineup here. Thank you. Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Julie McFarlane. I'm a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, and my written testimony is being passed out for the committee. And we had a pretty major debate in our legislative committee at our office about whether or not to support this legislation, because we are very concerned about the failure of many mandatory reporters to report child abuse. And in my testimony, I cite a number of studies that have demonstrated that among all classes of mandatory reporters, there is significantly less than 50% reporting across the board when they are surveyed about their reporting activity. However, we know that for 30-plus years, we have had penalties in our statute, as have other states that have mandatory reporting statutes, and rarely, if ever, have those statutes been enforced to impose the criminal and civil penalties that are provided for in them. And we felt that increasing the penalties alone cannot address this serious problem of underreporting. We believe that increasing the penalties is unlikely to lead to more enforcement. And we have to also question the fairness of imposing these increased penalties when most mandatory reporters are not provided with the kind of training and education that they need, and when the statutes themselves are confusing and ambiguous about the reporting requirement and the child abuse laws. In terms of the lack of training, which I think is the major issue here, we do not have training in any of our professional schools for people who are going to enter careers as mandatory reporters, and that is something that the legislature can and should require in law schools, in social work schools, in schools for people who are getting medical degrees, degrees in psychology, all of the professional areas of people who deal with children and are mandatory reporters. And I think that this is as important or more important than providing an annual or every 3 years, as it is in the case of attorneys, kind of hour-long training. In a college setting, there should be, and there is a curriculum that's been developed by the National District Attorneys Association for use in colleges through the University of Maryland, which is a full credit course about child abuse. It specifically applies to the different types of professions, so there's different types of training being provided, but it's very important to not only be informed every couple of years about what your reporting requirements are, but to really understand child abuse and neglect and the signs of that and what you are likely to see in your professional capacity when you deal with children who are being abused and neglected. So that is one of the recommendations that we would make, is that we focus on having that training occur in our colleges and universities and for all undergraduate and graduate level professionals who will become mandatory reporters. Then we also should require training, and I think in some cases that training needs to be annual training. The OYA caseworkers that Mr. Travis is going to train next week is a good example. Those are employees who deal with children on a daily basis and should be trained annually. Other persons, and I think perhaps lawyers, it's appropriate, are trained every 3 years. People who are social workers and teachers who deal with children every day should, in my view, be trained annually as well. Lastly, then, our child abuse reporting laws date back to the 1970s. They came out of a federal model law, and a lot of times model legislation does not fit very well into our state statutory scheme, and that is really true of the child abuse reporting law. It is so inconsistent with our juvenile code, which is very broad in terms of the types of cases that can be brought into juvenile court in order to stop or prevent abuse of children. But our child abuse reporting law is based primarily on definitions that are contained in the criminal code, and this is one of the major problems that we see in terms of investigation of abuse, that there is a real misconception about what the standard of proof is in an investigation of child abuse and what the criteria for abuse are, because in our code they reference to the criminal code, so that there's kind of an understandable mistake in believing that you have to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which often leads to a conclusion, for example, that there must be a bruise in order to validate that there's physical abuse, but that actually is not necessary under the lesser standard in juvenile court of preponderance of the evidence. And so it is really past time and important to take a look at these laws and to revise them, and recommend that the committee ask the Oregon Law Commission to revise the child abuse reporting laws and the abuse jurisdictional statute in the juvenile code in the next interim, and to come back to the following session.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. McFarlane, it's a good suggestion that this is a good project for the Law Commission. I don't know if we can't get something this session that satisfies people. I think you're right. I think the whole section needs to be reviewed. So I appreciate your comments.
And certainly some of Mr. Travis's comments would indicate that too, the ambiguities of the law. Thank you. Mr. Junef.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junef. I'm the director of Oregon Advocacy Center. One of our roles in state and federal law is to respond to complaints of abuse and neglect, and so we've been very involved with these issues for years. Sometimes I say my job is abuse. I hope it's helping to prevent abuse. I think that you've heard a lot of good wisdom from the previous witnesses on this topic, people who've worked very closely on these issues, because I hear what they have to say and I find myself nodding. My testimony specifically deals with some of my frustrations about our protective services and abuse reporting systems, and really this goes to what Ms. McFarland was saying, is that we have four different statutes. They all have different standards. They require different things of different people, sometimes different things of the same people. They run through different agencies, and trying to keep track of all that for anyone who has a responsibility under those laws is a very difficult thing. Efforts to try to help move along protections for people have I think, had mixed results. I'm an attorney. I've had training in child abuse reporting, and I can tell you that the attitude of every participant is not what you might hope for. And that may be symptomatic of a broader problem in terms of getting the information to the people that you need to get the information to, who can use it effectively. I think that the idea of concentrating in this area, though, is very important, and here's why. I personally don't have a lot of faith in the criminal justice system in terms of protecting people with disabilities. I know that we in agencies fight to have district attorneys prosecuting cases and to have police investigate cases that are really, they seem to be, feel to be too difficult, credibility of the witnesses is difficult. There's lots of problems in those cases. But trained social service professionals who can respond to complaints and provide protective services, that is, do the things that are necessary to protect that person with disabilities or that elderly person from continued abuse, is absolutely essential. It's an unfunded or lightly funded area, particularly in some of these areas. It's one in which we don't have enough training and we don't have the right people getting the training to recognize abuse and make those reports. I think if we had a work group that really concentrated on those features, we could make this a system that worked much better and prevented the kind of abuses that we want to prevent, rather than having some type of a response down the road that takes a long time and ultimately is not satisfying. So I think on the right track here, I think there's just more work to be done. And I'm very happy that the committee is looking at this area.
Thank you very much. Questions? Mr. Taylor.
I'm sorry.
Your counsel. He's Taylor.
That was actually the first name on the list of the next panels. If you wanted the other folks with me, or I can just go, whichever you prefer.
Oh, actually, that's fine. We'll just segue into the next panel.
Okay.
You, Maura Roach, and Scott Gallant.
And Maura had to leave for another meeting, but I have her handout for you.
Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor, and I'm here representing the Oregon Nurses Association. I know I want to start on behalf of the nurses by acknowledging that this is a very important and serious problem. I suspect most of us have had some situation in our life where we've seen abuse and felt like someone could have done something, and it didn't happen. And we empathize with that feeling of helplessness, and also that sense that we'd like to have seen something done, sense of need for justice. And I think that's at the heart of this bill, that you don't want to see people victimized and not get justice and not hold people accountable that should have done the right thing. There's also a very fine line here. Representing nurses, these are folks who are licensed to exercise judgment in an array of situations, and I haven't heard any concerns about how nurses exercise that judgment. But they're put in a situation all the time where they're facing people who have injuries or circumstances, and their first priority is working on helping those folks recover. If the remedy to a failure to report is too serious, and a healthcare provider is thinking about the fear of using their judgment incorrectly, I think you run a real risk of people reporting too often, reporting things that weren't really abuse, creating an unintended consequence. It's not justice to have people fail. fail to have a reporter report, but it's also not justice to have a whole lot of people who've done nothing wrong in the system because the folks who are responsible for reporting were in that much fear. And I think you're treading very close to that line when you talk about jail time. I would say that there is a way to address this issue rather than creating a bigger stick. And you've heard a lot about it today, but it really goes to an education and a culture. And those are ways that I think you can improve people's responsiveness. I think it depends a lot on the kind of licensee you have. In healthcare, I think people are very aware and often trained by their employers and as part of their education curriculum in the area of abuse and how to identify it. But I think that there are many different licenses that you're talking about in this legislation, and maybe there's some value to that. I think that there is a fear that if you report abuse now and are incorrect, that you could face a penalty for that, whether it's from employment or from a civil action. There may be some ways that you can get this problem that simply make it easier for people to identify abuse and to feel safe reporting it. But our concern is that you could have unintended consequences the way it's currently drafted.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Thank you. Oh, and on Maura's behalf, because I don't think she's going to make it back in time, there was a grid that she prepared that shows that there are seven different bills on the issue of abuse and then five different committees in the process, and that maybe we're taking a bit of a scattershot approach, that this is certainly an important question, and it might be helpful to have the discussion on all these bills in one place rather than happening all over the building. So I'm paraphrasing Maura's remarks.
Thank you very much. I am going to, I have several people left on this list, but there are people who are around here all the time, and so I think we're going to hold on to this bill for today, Senator Walker, and I'm going to close the public hearing and move on to try to get a little bit of comment on another bill where people have come from outside the building. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 372 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 947. Well, before we do that, everything else on the agenda we will be moving to tomorrow's meeting. We're going to have kind of a carryover to tomorrow's meeting. Thank you for the phraseology.
Didn't they tell us we're going to get back to this bill tomorrow? I think they're gone.
Oh, wait a second. No, was that a different bill?
That 947?
I thought that was 221. Oops. That was, excuse me, I messed up, everybody. We will not hear Senate Bill 947. I mixed it up with another bill, and they already left. So we will use our remaining time to have a work session on, be quiet, on Senate Bill 240.
Shut up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 240 comes to you from the Joint Intern Judiciary Committee, and you have the dash two amendments in front of you. This creates the Criminal Justice Research and Policy Institute with the Mark Hatfield School of Government. Basically, what the dash two amendments do is, despite all the changes, the main change is from a shall to a may. The amendments also reduce, they change the appointment process. When I say shall to a may, down on page one, it says the created, it shall provide assistance to the Oregon Legislative Assembly and state and local governments. And the shall there is changed to a may, so the Oregon Hatfield School of Government may assist the Legislative Assembly and state and local governments in developing policies to reduce crime and delinquency. And then through A through C. The other main amendment is that what it does is it would have an advisory committee that was made up of members from the legislature and the executive department, the judicial department, and it changes that to a 9-member advisory board appointed by the governor. And the main significance of changing the shall to a may is it eliminates the fiscal impact. Going back to when we last had a hearing on this bill in February 7th, you may have heard, we heard from Ben DeHaan, who at that time was with the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State, and I believe Claudia Black is here now. Ben moved on up to Seattle, but at the time he testified that they would like to have this within their school, even if they did not receive funding for it, because it would assist them in helping get grants to do research. So what this would be, for example, if the Oregon Youth Authority could come to them and say, we need someone to evaluate our programs to see if they're evidence-based and whether they're working, they could enter into contract with this new entity at the Hatfield School of Government, the Criminal Justice Research and Policy Institute. As
and
I said,
just lets them get funding.
Yes, it says they may do these things. So they could say, I'm sorry, we don't have the money, so we can't do it. It doesn't mandate that they do it.
Correct. Thank you very much. The chair loves this bill, and the chair loves the amendment. So, Senator Starr, do you have a motion on this amendment?
Well, what do you know about that?
No pressure here.
We do have people who can answer questions if anybody has any. Did I mention that Portland State University is in the district of the chair?
No, you didn't, Madam Chair, but I think I knew that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 240.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 240. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 240 as amended to the floor of the DuPass recommendation.
Council?
Madam Chair, this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee. I believe we have removed the fiscal impact by changing the shall to a may, because it does not obligate the Hatfield School Government.
Okay.
What that means is amendment has to be DuPass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee be rescinded.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 240 as amended to the Senate floor with a DuPass recommendation and a recommendation that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
I heard him say that, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He's very articulate on these matters. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the staff measure summary, it says the funds are going through criminal finance assessment and public safety fund. Is that removed by the Dash 2 amendments?
Yes.
Yes.
Correct. Any other questions, discussion?
He's awake over there.
So ordered. I will carry that. I don't mean to hog all the bills, committee, but that's just the way it goes, the way the cookie crumbles. Okay, we're going to open up a very brief work session on Senate Bill 61. I'm informed that there is agreement and enthusiasm on all sides.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 61 comes to you from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And this bill redefines, it relates to private security officers. You have the Dash 2 amendments in front of you, and I believe that there's an understanding for the private security providers and the Public Safety Standards and Training Department on the amendments.
Okay, Council, I'd like just a very brief summary of what the Dash 2 amendments do. Because I can't find mine right.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It will be brief. What it does is on page 3, I have the amendments.
I know they're here somewhere.
This could be like a training time tape where we all give you our amendments.
On page 3, Madam Chair, members of the committee, it adds on page 3 on line 29, after staff, and let me read it. A person performing crowd management or guest services, including but not limited to a person described as a ticket taker, or usher, or parking attendant, or events staff, and after that insert a person employed for the purposes of age verification by a licensee of the Oregon Licensing Control Commission who is not armed and is not hired with the primary responsibilities of taking enforcement action as described. And that places that within ORS 181-870-181-887 do not apply to, and so it does not apply to K with the addition of a person employed for the purposes of age verification by a licensee of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. You may remember some discussions about that. And Chairman's committee, and then you go over to page 5 after line 32. Insert subsection 3, the board, in consultation with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, may establish by rule accreditation standards for required training programs. The board, in consultation with the Private Security Policy Committee, may establish to what extent training or education programs offered by employers may be considered an equivalent to required training programs. And then, Madam Chair, members of the committee, going over to page 6 on line 3, it would insert a new subsection, small e, so that would be basically in the same section, and it would go back to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training shall, and that's on page 5, line 33, where it starts 3, and then going to now the newly, in collaboration with the Private Security Policy Committee, establish fees for accrediting training programs offered by the employers. And then it would add a new subsection 5, in establishing procedures for issuing certificates and licenses under subsection 4A of the section, the department shall establish a procedure for issuing a certificate of license to a person upon submission by the person of proof of succession completion of a training program accredited by the board pursuant to subsection 3 of this section as being equivalent to the required training program offered by the department. The rest of the amendments are basically changing numbers and
Thank you. This is kind of a, it allows a certification for private security, and I was just, it looks to me like they've avoided the necessity for a fiscal, is that correct? Is there any fiscal impact on?
Madam Chair, there's no.
I think it's.
There's no subsequent referral, Madam Chair, to Ways and Means, and I, in all fairness, the amendment that what I have from LFO is that does not affect local government. It doesn't appear that they have a fiscal impact. It appears to be minimal, but in all due deference to LFO, they haven't seen the Dash 2 amendments, but I'm operating on the same assumption that it does not, and the body language I'm getting from the department people that are here is that it does not.
Okay.
But obviously that final call is for legislative fiscal office.
Correct. Well, why don't we just take it, because I think it is, Senator Krasanski's right, I think this is other funds, it's discretionary, so it's, why don't we just confirm that on the record if you would. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Harold Burke Sivers. I'm the Director of Public Safety at the University of Portland, also Chair of the Private Security Policy Committee, and also on the board of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And as far as the fiscal impact is what you want me to address, we don't see any fiscal impact for the state at all. The accreditation, right now, what the bill is doing is allowing us to accredit other companies' training programs as long as they meet the a certain standard. And so we have to figure out was maybe if there's a fee base for that accreditation, which the constituents will pay. We'll determine that with our constituents and their representatives. So it'll be what we're anticipating now after having discussions with DPSST, it'll be a pretty nominal fee. Because we don't have someone doing it right now, and so we'll have to find an individual to do the accreditation process.
But under the current statute, they pay for their training.
Correct, and that's exactly why. Because we can use those same fees, and then they'd have to just be some for an individual just to move the accreditation forward process forward.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one of the research aspects... Julie Brandis, Associated Oregon Industries. One of the research aspects that Harold did help us with was finding out how many companies currently fall under the Act. That's about 44 companies in the state that are retailers who have to go through the program. So we did a gigantic math problem at over at AOI one day and figured out just about what the fee might have to be to make sure those 44 companies could just be accredited, and it is... something I think our members are willing to,
yep.
to pay.
Well, about this bill had a lot of discussion and controversy when it was first introduced, so good work reaching what sounds like a very good compromise. Senator Starr, do you agree this is a good compromise?
I agree.
So what about these Dash 2 amendments?
Yes, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 61.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 61. Is there discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Starr.
I move Senate Bill 61 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 61 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Yes. Madam Chair, I just want to point the record. I haven't had a chance to look at the Dash 2s entirely. I'll be voting for it, but if I change my mind, because this is one that I did have concerns with in the original form, okay. I'll let the Chair know before it gets to the floor.
Please do, and if it's solvable, there are ways to deal with that.
Yep.
Senator Byrd?
Madam Chair, I can count four without my vote, so I'm voting against the bill because I thought the bill was a solution in search of a problem when it first came forward, and I haven't had a chance to talk to anyone about it since then.
Okay. Well, your job is clear, folks out there. So let's take a quick roll call on the motion to send Senate Bill 61 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Brzezinski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo? Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Make it
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Okay.
So, order.
Madam Chair, we're going to move the other bills we haven't done to tomorrow.
Can we?
We need a carrier. We need a carrier.
Can't be me.
Can't be you. Oh, that's right. Can't be you.
I'll carry if I don't have objection, but I can't.
Senator Starr, do you want to carry this bill?
I'll carry it.
Senator Starr will carry this bill. We will move all the.
567 is no amendments.
There's no amendments?
Yeah, we got some.
Let's move this out. Open a work session on Senate Bill 567.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 567 comes to you from Senator Brzezinski, creates a traffic offense of failing to properly secure a child. And what this basically does is. Two classifications, Madam Chair. No amendments, no fiscal impact.
Senator Starr.
Who?
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 567 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation, discussion, objection, so ordered. Senator Brzezinski, you carry.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we're going to move the bills that you're not heard, so it would be 947.
All the remaining bills on the agenda will be moved to tomorrow's meeting.
Okay, that would be 947, 251, and 372, too. Do you want to finish up testimony on that tomorrow, or do you want to wait for another
We're going to wait a little bit on that one. 221, 947, 240, 251.
Okay.
Senate Judiciary is adjourned. Bam.
Thank you.
Thank you.